Great, thanks. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here and to add to our cheerful subject. Somehow at that meeting in Santa Fe, it's not surprising, they begged me to stop talking about the abscesses of homeless heroin addicts and something more cheerful. So somehow I was persuaded to take a 25-year look at the half dozen or so fieldwork sites. Not a very smart thing to do in 20 minutes, so it'll be sort of like haikus from these sites. But to organize it around how I was understanding and looking at violence during this historical era, violence in the Americas specifically, during this historical era of the transition from the Cold War conflict to the global consolidation of, you know, what could be called a corporate militaristic neoliberalism. I'm especially interested in the periods of transition from revolutionary and wartime political violence to interpersonal delinquent violence, and most important, and their overlaps. Most importantly, I want to offer some theoretical tools to address the rising salience of violence globally and locally. Now, of course, over the years I've worried that I might be obsessed with violence, but unfortunately, it's the topic, I would argue, that imposes itself on us, because violence is central, unfortunately, to organizing everyday life, and morphs its forms in confusing ways that fuel more violence. There is a danger, of course, in contributing to a voyeuristic pornography of violence, but a much bigger problem, I would argue, is not seeing violence where it exists. And in this vein, I do apologize because some of the pictures from my fieldwork sites will be painful and shocking to some viewers. But by the way, for acknowledgments, all the good black and white pictures like this slide photo are taken by my collaborator, Jeff Schomburg, and the mediocre color snapshots are mine, except for two you'll see are good, and they're by Susan Mizellis. But in the crack house in East Harlem. In a nutshell, I'm then beginning with a conceptualization of violence that Nancy Shepherd Hughes and I developed, thinking of it as operating along a continuum that includes overlapping categories of structural violence, symbolic violence, and everyday violence. And today I'm adding, as separate from those categories that we had originally had, intimate violence, and I'll explain why. Theoretical categorizations often obscure as much as they elucidate, but I found these categories useful, and they're not exclusive of the dozens of other more specific forms and manifestations of violence. They're only meant to be starting points for approaching violence in a way that facilitates recognizing the roots, links, tentacles, diversity, and pervasiveness of violence's multiple forms and effects. So for brevity's sake, with respect to this list of four, I'm only going to take the two that people get confused with because they have commonsensical terms that are what they're not about. Bourdieu's symbolic violence isn't about insults. It's about thinking the insult is true, and that's the crucial, powerful, and devious dynamic of symbolic violence, because it makes you think that the world is the way it is because it deserves to be that way, because you deserve to be dominated because of, you know, your essence. Everyday violence that Nancy Shepherd Hughes coined working in a shanty town in northeastern Brazil, she meant to refer to the social indifference to the outrageous suffering that she was seeing all around her, watching the babies of mothers dying of malnutrition. And specifically, one of the examples she gives is the mayor's office financing the construction of coffins for the newborn, but not programs for rehydration. She's also done it in other settings, as in insane asylums, looking at the rituals of of humiliation that take place between nurses and doctors and patients. But now I've added intimate violence to the three categories in that original formulation in the continuum, because I think it needs to be separated from everyday violence, where we formerly had it sort of sloppily hanging, because of its visibility, and I would argue, as I'll be arguing here, its key role in fomenting the foundations for symbolic violence. And I find these four categories, once again, useful because they span moments of war and peace with great malleability. Furthermore, their linkages and relationships to one another tend to get misrecognized by the general public, and that confusion legitimizes oppressive power structures. So now, jumping to the ethnographic haikus, and I don't have pictures for the first three fieldwork sites. The first one was as an applied anthropologist for the agrarian reform ministry in Nicaragua during the first 3 years of the Sandinista Revolution, from 1979 through 1981. I watched an inspiring mass mobilization for indigenous rights turn into a bloody civil war in a racist and cultural nationalist idiom. The violence was, on one level, a response to the structural violence of internal colonialism. But more importantly, it was primarily driven and shaped by a rejection of symbolic violence. And it was interesting for me because the whole model for understanding, you know, what the Mosquito Indian needed by the central government was an ecolemistic one. But what they were demanding was their language back and to be transformed from being the scum of the earth to the chosen people of the earth. And that's how it played itself out in a very bloody mobilization, and on both sides, where cultural nationalism emerged on both sides of the conflict, the Latino government soldiers and the indigenous guerrillas, spawning an interpersonal brutality in the name of politics of killing traitors and with the Mosquito being and one sees this in Iraq now, especially brutal against their own people, who they conceive of as betraying them as suddenly having become the chosen people. And now this is on some level inherent in mobilizations against symbolic violence, as people like France Fanon argued in colonial Algeria. It in some sense requires a brutality for itself. But contra Sartre's argument of it being necessarily liberating, as history has revealed, and in this Cold War context, the CIA came in and financed and organized the Mosquito conflict against the Sandinistas to then exacerbate its bloodiness. It was really a sad moment to see. It had a semi-okay ending in the sense that they got regional autonomy eventually. In my second fieldwork, 1981 to 1984, I continued the themes of the experience of internal colonialism and institutionalized racism while living in the workers' barracks of a 6,000-person U.S. banana plantation spanning the borders of Panama and Costa Rica. It was during a period of peace, but labor leaders were being killed by the Costa Rican government police, the most peaceful of all Latin American countries. That's the tragedy of it. There was also a great deal of domestic violence and drunken brawling that I did not document. I documented the structural violence and the human rights deaths of the labor leaders, but did not theorize the intimate violence as a phenomenon related to the structural violence and producing a symbolic violence. Now, my third fieldwork interrupted my second fieldwork. This was in 1981, and I've been continuing it to the present. I went into a territory controlled by FMLN guerrilla fighters during the Salvadoran Civil War, thinking of myself as an applied anthropologist, to document human rights violations by the military government that, of course, as you know, was financed and advised by the U.S. Government. I also wanted to document a liberating violence among peasants. Now, I got trapped in a scorched earth campaign launched against a 40 square mile region of 12 hamlets by the military government, and fled for 14 days under fire with about 1,500 civilians and about 150 guerrilla fighters. So about 250 of us were killed over those 14 days, and about 25 guerrillas. I documented what I understood as structural and symbolic violence being overthrown in a utopian political idiom. But I didn't recognize the ongoing, intimate, interpersonal violences that were coexisting and morphing, being replaced, but then popping back up. The violence of the peasant revolutionaries appeared to be solely redemptive. The ongoing existence and logics of intimate violence remained invisible to me. I thought it had been successfully channeled in some sense into a political mobilization away from internalized interpersonal violence. And I was only able to see the ongoing intimate violence years later, after the Cold War ended under neoliberal peacetime. Now, my next field work that's Susan's photograph. From 1985 to 1991, I lived with my family next to a crack house in East Harlem in order to document the effects of what I call U.S. inner city apartheid by befriending a social network of crack sellers and their families. The site was enmeshed, obviously, in structural, symbolic, and intimate violence par excellence. For anyone, those were the two main characters in Search of Respect, and if you've read it, you can tell who's Primo. Hopefully, if I wrote the book well, you can tell who's Primo and who's Caesar. The fieldwork experience at that time, faced with what I was unprepared for, and a very upsetting level of intimate violence, motivated me to document the links between this very visible intimate violence that you can't escape on the street in a crack house or around a crack house, and the invisible violence that was fueling it, and to theorize that. Now you remember that this was during the consolidation, the height of the consolidation of the new neoliberal model, or the more savage version of neoliberalism that Reagan had just introduced in the 1980s, and that had finally trickled down in the form of the height of the crack epidemic hitting in 1985, by the time the effects of the Reagan policies were hitting. And it was also, of course, the moment of the tremendous escalation in the war on drugs that made the United States the nation with the highest per capita incarcerated population, although Rwanda actually has a higher per capita. But every now and then, I forget whether it's Kyrgyzstan or there's one or two other countries that push the U.S. out. But we're way off the charts. We can't even, I had a thing and then I ran out of time. And now I'm talking about it, but you can't even present it accurately on a chart, because the U.S.'s rate is so much higher than the European rate, 6 to 10 times higher. Okay, so my next field work from 1991 to 93 was conducted jointly with Jim Quesada and Jeff Schomburg among a network of neighborhood gang members on the block where I lived in San Francisco's Mission District. By our choice of site, we were trying to link interpersonal gang violence in the United States to the historical effects of U.S. military violence in Central America and the Middle East. For example, that woman is actually breaking up a fight between one of the Salvadoran gang adolescents, who himself is the son of refugee parents, and that boy was fighting with the Palestinian store owner, who was also himself a war refugee from his natal land, and he had, because of his refugee status in Jordan, had served in the Jordanian military and kept a gun by his cash register. This is the idiocy of drunk, men in these scenes playing with guns when they're drunk. And he was also a business major at San Francisco State, and the fight was actually she's actually crack smokes crack, and the gang kids are underage, so they were usually able to get her to buy beer for her, and the storekeeper had said, no, I won't sell you underage kids beer through her. And so he had come in to beat up the store owner for doing that, and she was then preventing him from doing that because she was older and more mature and didn't want unnecessary violence. No, I'm serious, actually. My next field work then began in 1994, the one they made me stop talking about at in Santa Fe, and is ongoing with Jeff Schonberg. Oh no, it's this one. Is ongoing with Jeff Schonberg. We're trying to theorize the continuum of violence approach to develop what we're calling a theory of lump and abuse, to understand the phenomenon of the destroyed lives of so many aging homeless heroin injectors and crack smokers on U.S. streets. This is one of the clean encampments in our social network that we've been following. Now, for example, in this photo, one sees different levels of abuse of violence. On the one, though, that hits you in the head, perhaps, is the overly visible self-inflicted one of him injecting into a scar, into an abscess on his rear. But of course, the very filth of the setting and the frequency of his abscesses are structural effects of the U.S. war on drugs. And more, perhaps even, and then also the discarded computer screen demonstrates that other structural force, the complete irrelevance of the homeless to Silicon Valley's .com biotech economic miracle. And this introduces that category of lumpen, a particularly vulnerable social category, especially tragically privileged in its relationship to violence. So now, simultaneously, from 2000 to the present, I've been supervising a related fieldwork project with indigent homeless youth in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, and being undertaken by Bridget Princh, Sarah Thibault, and Jeff Schonberg. And we've had to emphasize the gendered domestic violence between addicted lovers on the street, because that is what, on one level, that's what they want to talk about, and it's also what's extraordinarily visible. And so the slashes that she's done on her wrist, you see the slashes, but on some level, as important or more importantly, you also see her boyfriend's initials proudly carved into her forearm. Then setting this in those other structural forces of racism in the war on drugs, without of course losing sight of the intimate embodied self abuse, as well as the joys of living in ecstasy that further mask as everyday routine violence on the street the participants in their own abuse. Because they think they're having fun. So, and they are having fun, actually. I mean, that's important to recognize as well. So now, during all these years, I've been revisiting the hamlets of the surviving revolutionary fighters and families in El Salvador. The country is now technically at peace, but according to official statistics, more people are dying due to intimate violence than when the killings were explicitly political during the Civil War. Now, this former guerrilla fighter was disabled by stepping on a landmine that had been placed by fellow guerrillas to disabled government soldiers. But there was a rumor that, and the explanation was that the mine's location had been confused. But there was this strong suspicion that maybe it had been placed by an infiltrated traitor, because this had happened to several other guerrilla fighters. But he had a different interpretation. He was convinced it was placed by his girlfriend's jealous ex-boyfriend. Now, what's bad about this is that all are objective possibilities, realistic possibilities. And after being demobilized in peacetime, he became a disabled peasant, unable to farm his field, which is located a mile away on a steep hill, became an alcoholic and living off of various women that he was manipulating. And 2 years after the picture, he was killed by his 14-year-old little brother because he was beating up their mother in a drunken rage when she wouldn't give him money for liquor. and the little boy used his older brother's gun from the guerrilla war to kill him. Now, worse yet, the reality is so much worse than anything you could invent. Worse yet, the little brother who killed him now lives in San Francisco and is covered with gang tattoos and scars. Last time I saw him at his aunt at a party that his aunt was throwing for the baptism of one of her children's babies, he borrowed $20 from me, and I was too scared to refuse him the money, and he ran off to smoke crack. So now returning, I guess I don't have time to return to the Scorched Earth campaign, but I'll go right to why I think it's useful to resurrect and reinterpret this category of lumpen. In the early 21st century, I think we need to re-examine Marx's class category of lumpen. That is to say, those sectors of the population who've been expelled from the economy, but render the concept useful in the 2000s by reinterpreting class to be a modifying concept rather than treating it as an absolute bounded category. And I do this by using Foucault's understanding, and I hope I'm not just babbling here, by using Foucault's understanding of subject, because it is 20 minutes, understanding of subjectivity, biopower, and governmentality to define the lumpen sector. Basically, in a nutshell, under contemporary neoliberalism, the effects of biopower combined with structural violence, that part still comes from Marx, have rendered governmentality overwhelmingly abusive to rising numbers of people. And this promotes then the emergence of these violent and destructive and often self-destructive subjectivities. In the continuum of violence, then, that spans war and peace, the lumpen disproportionately shift the practice of violence towards intimate, routinized violence, and that then generates more symbolic violence. Another twist, of course, that has terrible global repercussions is that they are also disproportionately at risk of becoming the fodder for state armies and for suicidal resistance, when the symbolic violence weighing on them is inverted, and when they're mobilized politically, especially when they're young, they can become patriotic U.S. Marines in the U.S. military, or the chosen children of God, as in Iraqi suicide bombers. Today, I would argue then, ever larger proportions, and this is the very end, world's population survive precariously in refugee camps, rural and urban wastelands, shanty towns, housing projects, tenements, prisons, and homeless encampments. And this is caused by identifiable economic forces, military interventions, and environmental degradation with fault lines, as has been suggested. And this point of the point that I want to end on is that in the neoliberal era, violence takes on a particular salience as it flows along its continuum and produces more of itself in overlapping but misrecognized forms. And to break the cycle that then generates symbolic violence out of this mess, a symbolic violence that weighs on the structurally vulnerable, we need to understand the weighted directionality of the flows of the violence. If, for example, structural violence is the invisible base of the iceberg of violence, it is then buttressed and administered through routinized everyday violence, and intimate violence could be its hypervisible tip, which is melting back to become symbolic violence upon which the whole entire structure of the iceberg floats to then get propelled to cause more destruction along its path. Okay, thank you.